Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you?
I do well. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you for inviting me for this.
All right, you bet. All right, let's get right into things. So let's start with your year of graduation, including if you finished up coursework, spring, summer, fall, and your major or majors.
Okay, I graduated in the spring of 24. I was for quite a while, I was a dual major with performance and MP&E, but my last semester I decided to just solely focus on MP&E, so I graduated with that degree.
Got it. So lots of performance coursework.
Yeah.
And great. And what was your principal instrument?
The saxophone.
Oh, very cool.
Thank
All
you.
right. So we will get to your history later. But for now, tell us about your current job. Where do you work? What do you do?
Right, excuse me. I sell business loans on Wall Street right now. I mean,
Oh, interesting.
it sounds cooler than it is. I'm a telemarketer for business loans, but
So a
I
business loan is in the business itself. It could be anything. It could be a hardware store. It could be
all
an
kinds of
importer,
industries.
anything.
Commonly I'll work with medical companies, restaurants, folks in the manufacturing space, logistics, some computer companies, but they're a little trickier just 'cause everything I do is revenue based and a lot of the tech startups aren't quite in an area where I can work with them.
Right, they usually go on investor money until they get big.
Right.
And I'm sorry, who's your employer?
It's a company called Getty Advance.
Getty Advance.
And then
Oh, wow.
our CEO's name is Abe Grazzi.
Okay, I wonder, is that Paul Getty? Wasn't he like the richest man in America at one point?
Yeah, different Getty, but yeah, Paul Getty, rich
Interesting.
guy.
Okay, and it's funny because I imagine there are conventional banks that do business loans. So
There are.
could you sort of say, like, how is Getty Advance different from Bank of America? I just picked one.
Sure. There's a few different ways. First and foremost, we do not have the bank rates. While I do sell the loans, 95% of the time, the loans I sell don't come from in-house money. I'm what's called a broker. So I connect private lenders with businesses, get deals set up, get documents signed, paperwork back and forth. I'm going through a traditional bank, you're getting really cheap money. You're getting prime plus one, prime plus 1.25 sometimes.
Okay.
But that process takes a while and it's very difficult to get that done. The niche that I fill is when folks need quick funding, right? So I'm typically able to turn it around within 24 hours, but it does come at a significantly higher cost.
Got it. They pay a higher interest rate. Can I ask in terms of loans, I've low familiarity, like I know there's sometimes it's just a line of credit, and then if it is like kind of a fixed loan, it can either be paid off, very slowly over 30 years, whatever, or it might be a, very quick payback. Is
Right.
this typically like short term, long term, any term because it's a line of credit? What's the typical?
So all three. So we do have lines of credit that we sell. A vast majority of our loan products are short term, as short as 3 months, as long as 36. On average, I'd say it's between 8 and 18 months. So
Okay.
quick turnaround times. We do also, in rare cases, go through banks for equipment financing and the SBA, which that's where you start getting into 5 to 30 years range.
Sorry, what's SBA in this case?
Oh, it's the oh gosh, I'm gonna sound like I'm terrible at my job. It's the Small Business Administration, I
This,
believe.
okay. Oh, yeah, federal agency. Got it.
Yeah, Small Business Administration.
Perfect. And can I ask a typical, again, don't name a client, don't give it exact, but like what's a typical size for the loan that you might be dealing with?
It's tricky to find something fully typical because it's the range I work in is between 5,000 and 5 million. I'd say like
Okay.
the healthy range is maybe between 40 to 135 $40,000. Most of my clientele are in that range.
Got it. So I don't ask people how much money they earned, except for, you know, there was that cutoff to qualify. But I am curious about the structure of your pay, right? Like, some sales jobs are pure commission, some are kind of hybrid, like half and half, some are all salary. What's the structure?
All right, so currently it's fully commission based. The way that my company makes its money is, like I said, I connect direct lenders with companies. Effectively, they sell me the money at one rate, and I upsell that to the business that I'm selling the loan to. So the commission structure is broken up out of that house split, whatever that difference is between our buy and sell rate.
Interesting. So the bigger the split, the better commission you get.
Right.
I'm just curious one thing about the business structure, and maybe you could answer this for me.
Sure.
I'm just thinking from the point of view of the lender, right? If I am somebody sitting in with a big pile of money and I'm hoping to turn that into more money, I'm going to look at different businesses, right? And there might be one business where, you know, it's the neighborhood pizza shop and it's been doing well, and maybe they need a little loan to replace their oven, but this thing's been in business for 40 years, shows no sign of slowing down. I feel very confident that I'll be paid back. And therefore, I'm not, right? So then I'm willing to charge a lower interest rate for that one versus, you know, if there's some other business that's brand new and maybe it's hopping on some trends, but who knows if the trend is still going to be there in a couple years, I'm going to be a lot more scared and want to be paid more, right? We call it the risk premium.
Right.
And so I guess my question is, if you're this broker with this, Clint, you said lenders just come to you all like, hey, we want to load some money. How are they willing to trust you that the companies they load their money to aren't going to go bust? You see what I'm asking?
Right. And so a lot of that comes into play in the underwriting process. While they're vetting the financials, they're vetting the business to see if it does qualify for what, like, a company they would lend to. So a lot of the big things they're looking at are what you said, right? It's time in business. It's online presence is huge, as well as consistent revenue or revenue that's trending upwards. Now, there's certain cases where not all of those three need to be in place. There's plenty of businesses, you know, an easy example, like a water park, right? They get 90% of their revenue throughout the year in the summer. Sure. So with seasonal businesses, you know, what we're looking at changes a little bit, but it's all about health of business and risk. You know, there's also certain industries that lenders really don't like. Like the worst one, they always joke around about it, is used car sales. Most lenders won't even touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Interesting. Okay. Got it. So it sounds like there's an underwriter process. Sorry, are you all the underwriters, or is that like some independent underwriter?
So we have it happens at two points. So we have a back office in my company where we do preliminary underwriting. We get everything presentable, ready for being delivered to the lender. Then at the lender, they'll do like a preliminary sweep over it, see if it makes sense. And then once contracts are out and signed, they go into final underwriting where they're doing a deep dive on everything, you know, credit history, criminal records, you know, like I was saying, the revenue, time of business, online presence, industry, all the different things to see if they like it.
Okay. Got it. Very interesting. And as you said, when you make a loan, is kind of that the end of your interaction with the client? Or I think of some companies where the salespeople, you know, the more senior ones tend to have much higher incomes because they keep a lot of the relationship with their clients. So if you'd like, I knew a company who sold software, and it was like if you made a new sale, you then were the person who called them back a year later, like, hey, it's time to renew. And that was considered easy money.
Absolutely. That's the goal for everyone, like who's getting into the industry I'm working in, is you set up that good book of business where, when that business owner needs something, you're the person they call. So, I mean, currently I only have four repeat customers. Granted, I've only been at this company for about 4 months now.
Sure.
But folks who, hey, I need some more capital, that's the bread and butter. You want to set it up so you have a consistent stream of those coming in. There's a lot of folks in the industry who will do like a one and done type of thing, but that oftentimes hurts the merchant in the long run more than it helps them. Like you want to set up a good relationship where you have trust and consistent back and forth.
Got it. Got it. So, can I ask? I'm sorry, where are you based? Is New York or?
Yeah, New York. I work on Wall Street.
You said that. Yes, my apologies.
All good.
And can I ask about how big's your office,
Yeah,
roughly?
it's relatively small. So it's broken up into our main office and our back office. So the main office is here in New York. The back office is in Serbia.
Okay.
In our main office in New York, we have 12 people. In the back office, I believe we have seven, but we might have six or eight.
That was way more accurate than I was expecting it to be. So, and it, of the, although I'll ask this, of the 12 people in your main office, how many are salespeople like you?
There's a couple of us that do multiple things, right? So we've got our CEO, and then our chief business development officer slash sales manager and a third manager. Those three, they both handle sales and non-sales tasks. And then we have one guy who does no sales in the office. He does a lot of the operations and marketing outreach stuff.
Sure. But most of you are spending sales, couple. Hybrid. All right. Excellent. Okay. Next question I have for you is let's measure your sales in terms of deals, right? Like a deal, you found a client, you found a interest rate slash lender that they're happy with. Everyone says, okay, yeah, let's do this. And then you earn some commission, right? So, kind of like how many deals in a typical month?
It varies. I think that the goal for me right now is to average three deals per week. I haven't hit that every time, but I mean, starting out, getting into it, a healthy range to aim for is, anywhere from 2 to 8 per month. It's a wide range, but with sales, sometimes you'll have a stretch where you just don't catch people at the right time. I've had my second month. So many folks were like, "Hey, call me in a month's time. I'll be ready in a month. I'll be ready in a month." And you wanna kind of set those up. But if you look at the whole year, I think averaging maybe five or six deals a month is really good, like really healthy.
Yeah, and I completely get that, a big deal is more Luke. I'm guessing the deal for twice as much money at the same spread is worth twice as much for you. So,
Right.
right. So that said, deals are not the perfect metric. I was just curious.
Yeah,
Remember,
we typically go by funded dollar amount. So the total amount that like the loans that you sold equaled out to. So I mean, I try and aim for between 300,000 and 500,000 every month.
Gotcha. Gotcha. That's very helpful. And can you take us through like a typical work day for you?
Yeah. So I start at 9, so I'll get into the office. In sales, it's very helpful to have a routine. You do the same type of thing every day so that when you measure what you're getting back out of it, you know that you have a control variable. So every day, I'll go in, I'll make a cup of coffee. Then the first 3 hours of my day from 9 to noon, I do what's called redials. So I call the people who I tried to get in touch with in days past that I wasn't able to get a hold of. And I'll kind of structure it so I start based on time zone. So I'll start just calling my East Coast clients and I'll slowly work my way west until noon when everyone's open. Then I'll wrap up any extras I have and then we start doing what are called research leads. So I'll get typically batches of 50 to 70 at a time and I have the name of the business, a phone number, hopefully an email as well and a name. but an address. My job is to verify that information, find out, okay, this is the phone number to get in touch with Mike, who owns company X. Then I'll call him up and I will try and kind of poke around a little bit, figure out where the need would be for money, right? You know, see if I'm able to get this guy some capital, is it going to net him more revenue in the future? So you establish kind of, hey, you know, what's going on? How's business? Are you looking to grow? Do you have any upcoming projects? Do you need to replace pieces of equipment? You know, whatever the need is, that's where I can add the most value. So that's how I'll frame the conversation, you know, figure out, hey, okay, now we know we have some interest. Next up, does this guy qualify or does this lady qualify? You know, so we'll find out what's the average revenue, you know, where's credit sitting? How long have you been in business? You know, do you have a website? If so, you know, is it a good website? Once they, you know, we go through this song and dance of I ask questions, they give answers, you know, EIN number, social address, phone number, email, all that stuff. Uh-huh. Then I'll collect bank statements for the business so I can look at the financials, and we send it to the back office. You know, then we'll get it back. Now I've got some numbers to work with. We can start feeling out what their affordability is, you know, close the deal. And that's the bulk of the day. Sometimes we'll do, they call them power hours, where they just have lists of hundreds or sometimes thousands of leads that the whole office just auto dials through. Just the computer will automatically call them in succession. But outside of that, I mean, that's kind of the bread and butter, is just get on the phones, talk to people, and find out where you can add value.
How many conversations do you have in a typical day?
Conversations versus calls, you know, it's
two different things, right? So right. Feel free to give two numbers there.
So, I mean, for calls I look at it in terms of conversations to calls are kind of indicative of each other, right? If I'm having a lot of conversations, I'm probably only making 200 to 300 calls per day. If I have a day like I had today where folks aren't picking up the phone, you know, I made 538 calls today.
Wow. Okay, that's interesting. When you said only 200 or 300 calls, I was like, holy yike. But as you know, a lot of those just didn't go through. And how many, if we don't count a conversation as I'm sorry they're not in, leave your number, they'll call back, but something of substance, like how many conversations happen in a day?
Oh, on a good day, anywhere from 5 to 20.
Gotcha. So there's a lot of churning through, and there's probably a lot of places are all set, and then you go for the ones who aren't.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's just a numbers game. It's like panning for gold. You know, you just, most of the time, you don't even get the owner. You get the receptionist. We call them gatekeepers. And they're like, oh, they're in a meeting, or, oh, they're not available. It's like, yeah, okay. Like, I'll talk to you again tomorrow, Susan. but yeah, so much of it is just sifting through nonsense to find the, you know, the few good conversations that will net you money.
I understand. So one thing, criteria that you had to hit in order to qualify for these interviews is that you enjoy what you do. So what is it about this sort of financial sales that you enjoy?
Yeah, so I actually didn't even plan on getting this job, but I've been in sales since my first summer, right after COVID started. But I put myself through school by doing door-to-door sales. And every summer I'd move to a different city in the country and go knock doors for a summer. Wow. And, you know, after graduation, I kind of shifted my focus to I want to have a life somewhere where I don't have to leave for half the year. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to find a place where I could transfer the skills I've already been building, because I do enjoy sales. It's fun. It's like mental gymnastics. You get to talk to people. You're forced to become very comfortable in awkward situations, which I enjoy. But, you know, I just looked for sales jobs in the city. And there was a little part of me that was like, oh, I want to work on Wall Street. I really want to work on Wall Street. And I actually, I applied to the company I work at as a joke. I didn't think I would get hired for something like this with my background.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, as you say, it's commission based, so it's perhaps less of a risk for them.
Right. And I do have experience selling loans outside of this job. I mean, I've got the experience that'll count towards something like this, but not the accolades, I guess, or the accreditation. You know, I don't have any
Sure.
type of degree in business or finance.
I understand.
But I have been selling loans for multiple years now. I did solar panels before business loans.
Okay. Oh yeah. Very cool. So, all right, then let's take it back now to 2024, although it sounds like the story may have a logical earlier starting point, like COVID. And let's say, I like you put us in your headspace as things are wrapping up Berkeley. And, you know, you sort of did a little bit already, but we'll go into more details and kind of take us one step at a time from where you were then to where you are now, both in terms of what you were doing for work, but also in terms of where you were at mentally in terms of your career.
Right. So my long-term goal, I want to open a studio. I want to rent the space or buy the space, buy the equipment, own a recording studio. And since I just graduated school, I was like, okay, how am I going to get there? You know, I'm a broke college kid. I need to have the money to go and live in New York, but more importantly, I need an actionable plan to get this studio going, because you know it's a very expensive facility that I want to build. You can't quite do that off of table scraps. So I went, I moved to Ohio for the entire summer right after graduation, and I sold solar there. I stayed
Can I
long.
ask where you're from?
No, I'm from about an hour west of Phoenix, Arizona.
Gotcha.
But I was living in Columbus. I sold solar there from about 4 days after graduation until Halloween of 24 or 25. No,
So over
24.
a year.
No,
okay,
yeah,
so
sorry. It's all kind of a blur. But
24, so like 4 months or something, or 5 months.
Yeah, I was there for about 5 months.
Okay, can I ask, like, why solar in Ohio? I mean, what?
So, yeah, the year before, I'd sold in South Carolina, and I did not enjoy that market or the group of people I was working with that
Okay.
much. So the core couple guys from that team, we took a chance and joined another group out in Ohio, because
so
that market.
Same company, different
yeah,
location.
Same company, different leadership, a different like region of the company.
Gotcha. All right, so you do that for 5 months. So what made you leave?
I could not stand it. Because the goal was always to move here in New York. You know, I had the apartment, so there was a really frustrating period that summer where I paid the whole summer at least rent twice per month. I'd have my place in Boston and my place in Ohio. Then there was a month where I did first, last security for New York, last month for Boston and Ohio at once. And I was like, I can't do this.
That's ugly.
Oh, yeah. But the alternative was try and figure out a place as I'm leaving Ohio and potentially get stuck there. So it was originally, you know, I was supposed to leave Ohio in August, you know, move in right at the 1st of September, you know, fly to Boston, grab my stuff, drive it down, then fly to Ohio and drive my car back to New York.
Okay.
But I wanted to make a little more money just to be a bit more comfortable. So I stayed into October. And then I was in kind of a weird limbo state, because I, you know, both my roommates had now been living here for a couple months and were starting to, you know, go out, get jobs, do things. You know, I was back, I was comfortable, so I didn't need to work. So I thought I would just take some time off. And then, you know, there was some like work trips, you know, they took me to Puerto Rico, they took me to Hawaii. I'm very grateful for the experience, but it let me kind of feel stagnant for a bit. So from Halloween to mid-April of this year, I was out of town for quite a bit of that time, between all those different places. I also went back to Phoenix for a bit to work, and Los Angeles as well. And so I got back and I was like, what am I doing? Like, I've lived in New York for 6 months, but I've spent a month here. So I went on Indeed and started applying for jobs and somehow landed the one I have now.
That simple.
Yeah, it was. I was expecting a lot more of a battle to. I got very lucky. That's, I guess, the
As
best
you
way to
said, you
describe
had
it.
lots of experience. Solar had the financial aspects of that attracted them, and you've been working in sales a bunch, sounds like, at summer jobs at Berkeley.
Right.
So, and so you just applied, got hired, and sounds like you're hired pretty much. There probably was just a little bit of training, and then you'd start doing what you're doing, right?
I mean, I was applying for like jobs in bars, you know, things that I could do and start building the freelancing career. And none of them reached back out except for all these like finance and sales positions. They're like 9 to 5. It was
All right,
very strange. I
that's
never
funny.
thought I'd find myself in this spot, but I'm enjoying it.
That's great. I'm going to ask a slightly personal question now.
Sure.
And I am not faulting your life plan at all. Let's just be clear on that. But you said your goal is to have your own studio. I'm sure you can imagine that there are plenty of MP&E majors who graduate Berkeley and they say, I want to be doing some good music in the studio. And what they do is they apply to work in a studio, right? And maybe they start as a runner, then assistant engineer, and then you kind of work your way up or, become a lead engineer at a smaller studio. And, you end up working high-end studios that way. Maybe at some point you start your own. But if they start at a lower position in studios, right? You're saying I want to do it myself, and therefore I'm gonna just work some other jobs, make a bunch of money, and that'll make that happen. Cool. But why are you on this track? What made you not just say I'm gonna apply to work in a studio after graduation, doing whatever crap they want me to do?
The biggest factor for that on my end was the financial stability of it, which is funny because I work a job that doesn't pay me hourly. But a lot of those entry level positions, you know, they wouldn't allow me to be where I want in the world. You know, I wouldn't be able to afford to you know, live here and do what I do on these smaller salaries. You know, I don't come from a background where I'm able to get financial assistance for anything. So
Gotcha.
that's kind of a mindset I developed as I went through school. Just because the only way I could get back for the fall semester was if I worked from a couple days after school went out for the summer until a couple days before we got back. Just
Gotcha.
because, well, I had the dual major, there was no chance of holding down a job and doing both those degrees. There wasn't enough time in the day.
Sure.
I mean, it's always been a thing of, you know, I need to be able to quickly and effectively make money so that I can cover my living expenses, so that I can focus the rest of my time on the music, on what I care about. But also, you know,
Yeah.
I see a lot of these people who own businesses versus working for businesses, and the ones that own them always seem to be a bit happier. I'd much rather own the studio, own the equipment, have a stake in it versus, I mean, I don't know. I'd love to work at a nice studio too, but it's kind of, I guess, out of necessity primarily.
No, I understand, and I understand that working for other people, there absolutely are pitfalls to that. And I'm all too familiar. I remember a long time ago being at a place who was like doing test prep, where they toot these like raises that you get the longer you were there and the better job you did. And I stayed there for a while and I was getting raises. And then at some point I realized that, okay, but now they were throwing the classes at the new people because they were cheaper. So, whereas, right, if you own it, the success is yours. It's not going to be taken away from you.
Absolutely. And eventually it gets to a point where the people who you hire to work for you run most of the business, you know? Like, I'd
Yeah.
love to be in a position where I've got this thing working and cranking and it's generating me money and I'm there because I love it. But if I want to go take a day and like go out on a boat or something, I can, you know?
All right, that's great. Cool. Let's move on to the next part of the interview, third part of three. So, and let me preface this next question with there is no right or wrong answer. So, these days, we're talking in October of 25. So, let's say, late spring, summer, early fall of 2025, what, if anything, has been your relationship with music?
I produce when I can. I haven't been gigging, which I'm not as happy about. I've been trying to just keep the saw sharp. The first few months of working this job have definitely, I've had to put a lot of stuff on the back burner just so I can adjust to the schedule and figure out where I have time that doesn't compromise my ability to do either of the two things I love. So I mean, it's like, I haven't been releasing music, which I want to do a lot more of. I haven't been going and playing gigs. I've been producing. I've been
producing for
listening
other people.
A lot. Yeah, I produce for a couple of friends out here. One of my roommates, funnily enough, I've been trying to find more clients, I guess, for production work. One of my professors from school, I've done some work for her on her album, since I've been here. But primarily I've been more of a consumer than a creator in music for the last 3-ish months. Which I'm not the happiest about, you know, but it's still the driving force in my life. You know, it's the reason I'm doing any of this other crap is so I can get to music, you know?
I completely understand. It's that, yeah, people set something to the side. I'm trying to figure out which category to put you in, and you'll excuse me if I'm a little bit crude. I have two categories. Among people who are still doing music and doing it with other people, I call people either casual or side job. And my cutoff for side job is, have you made at least $750 in the last 6 months?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. That was easy. You know, one person that might mean, yeah, I made 800. Another person might mean, yeah, I made 30,000, right? But, you know, whatever it is.
Right. I'm somewhere between the two.
Very fair. Okay. So, next question I have for you is, right, Berkeley gives, well, most people going to Berkeley, large majority, earn the Bachelor's in Music degree. You are one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Berkeley is a music college, right? Every degree there is related to music. You went there knowing that. And I'd say, of course, a Berkeley degree, there are plenty of jobs that say bachelor's degree required. They don't care what it's in. Fine, Berkeley's a bachelor's degree. But let's say, beyond the fact that Berkeley is a bachelor's degree, is there anything you feel your Berkeley experience did particularly well to prepare you for your current job?
Oh my goodness, yeah. It's the time management. It's the being under intense pressure. Because, you know, while I don't get paid hourly, so I do have a lot of agency over the time I spend at work and what I do with it. It's also, if you don't perform, you get cut. You know, and at Berkeley, it was very similar. You don't perform, you're not getting called back for the gig. You're not getting called to the studio again. There's a lot of stuff, a lot of moving pieces, parts you're working with, being able to schedule with people, being able to communicate, network. I mean, I think Berkeley's the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Okay. All right. Sounds great. Let's flip that question around now. Because again, Berkeley gives that music degree. You went there knowing that, and you're doing well for yourself. You just said that you're happy about Berkeley. But all that said, you know, when you look back at your Berkeley education, is there anything where you say, you know, hey, it would have been really useful to learn this while I was at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Is there anything you feel is missing or incomplete in your education?
I think that the only thing I wish I had more of during my time at Berkeley was education on the business side of music. I think that, because ultimately you go there to be a specialist, right? You go there for a discipline of music that you want to pursue.
Right.
The problem is a lot of, at least things I've heard from some people that are now outside of school, is they have to figure out how to operate themselves as a brand or as a business, not
sure.
fully from the ground up, but there's a lot of things that they wish they'd known earlier, you know, things like contract literacy or Well, I guess, I don't know. I also didn't take that many business classes while I was there. You know, that's kind of a hindsight being 2020.
Well, let's not fault yourself on that too much, right? Because, you know, Berkeley has decided that everybody needs a certain amount of ear training, right? And there are other courses. Berkeley's decided that everyone needs two English courses. And
Right.
if everybody, you know, we don't give people the option to skip ear training 1, 2, 3, 4, and then they, you know, go splat in their ensemble.
Right.
Right. Well, we say, hey, look, we've decided you need this stuff to be successful. So there is a universe in which Berkeley says, hey, y'all need like six business courses to be successful.
Right.
Right. So and they don't give you the option to neglect that part. So I think it's a very fair critique.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think by any means that it was lackluster, because the opportunity is always there. But I definitely think that having, you know, even if it was just two or three courses that in very general detail go over some of the more basic practices beyond, like, this is a contract and this is what a royalty is. I think training the students to be a bit more business savvy in music might be something that would be an advantage, but I do also think there's an emphasis on being out there, and while you're a student, trying to break into it and understand it so that you can use the resources you have to gain information.
All right. Very good. So next question I have for you is, you know, you managed to land on your feet economically, you know, very, very quickly. You know, you started doing sales while a college student and kind of kept right on doing it very successfully. But I guess my question is, for other people from your graduating year who haven't found their footing, or maybe people in their third, fourth year at Berkeley who are staring out to the big, scary world or going, yeah, I'm not sure what's going to come next, what I do. What, if any, advice do you have for all them?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things don't go as planned. And I think that being prepared to take opportunities when they appear in front of you, even if they're not necessarily the most direct path to your goal, I think that's going to lead people to be happier and have an easier time, at least financially, as they come out. You know, it's scary, it's hard, you're going to fall on your face, you're going to feel excuse me, feel overwhelmed. But I mean, ultimately, everyone who genuinely wants to and tries to figure it out will. You know, it's just a matter of time.
Gotcha, that's great. And finally, I think I mentioned you're my 269th interview, I think. Could be off by one or two there.
Right.
But, you know, you're, I don't think you're my first person who's doing financial sales, but, you know, maybe you're my fifth.
Right.
And I strongly suspect that anyone who's made it this far is potentially interested in financial sales. So,
Right.
right. So for someone, maybe they're not doing it yet, but they're really thinking about it and saying, hey, you know, the money's pretty good. There's a lot of aspects of obnoxiousness that I don't hit in a lot of other jobs, right? You're not
Right.
getting dirty. You're not getting, you know, having to duck under the thing that could rip your arm off. You're not, you know, you get the idea that there's so for somebody who's kind of thinking, hey, maybe I'll give this a shot, or should I give this a shot? What advice do you have for them?
Be consistent. It's a very, very brutal skill to learn. It's a very useful skill to have, but the returns you get in a job like this are, it's just, you can't really equate it to how most things work. You know, it's like when you're, it's honestly similar to learning music, just because it's a skill that's based on fundamental principles that you develop and then apply. So I think that musicians, funnily enough, oftentimes are predisposed to being able to handle it. It's also an overwhelming amount of rejection. You know, no is not a bad thing to hear. It's the thing you're going to hear most in the world, but learning to not attach your ego to those no's is the thing that's going to separate someone who's not doing well or doing kind of okay with someone who's doing great. You know, it's about input entirely, not output.
Gotcha. That's great advice. Yes. So I just have one last question for you, Tom, which is that you have the mic. Is there anything we missed or anything else you'd like to say?
To anyone who's in the tail end of their experience at Berkeley, I mean, take advantage of the things that are available to you there. I mean, there's not a day that goes by that I don't just wish I could do a 2 to 6 a.m. session. Like spend time, especially in the studios, and I'm an MP&E student, but spend time in the studio, engage with the people around you. Build a network at school so that even if all of your friends don't move to the same city, you've got connections and opportunities around. You know, it's a truly special place that we're all have been fortunate enough to spend time at.
All right. But that's great. Well, thank you so much, Tom, for making the time tonight. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Absolutely. Likewise.
All right, great. Well, best of luck with everything. And
Yes, sir. Thank you so
have a great
much. And
evening.
hopefully you don't have a crazy, crazy amount of these left to do. I hope you're a good chunk of the way through your
I
interview.
mean, there's not an end point here except when I retire. I've been doing this for over 10
Well,
years.
then I hope that the next batch of interviews are very entertaining.
Thank you very much. Have a great evening.
Likewise. Bye now.